I am Plata on the line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. Ian Williams is considered one of the country's most original talents on the literary landscape. He has just published a new novel, his debut, Reproduction. It was published earlier this month, and I spoke to him a couple of weeks ago while he was in Toronto doing press for the book. We talk about the unique, funny characters in his book, as well as the stretch of time we follow them through the book. The book contends with family, blood or otherwise, as well as the need for some to have children. Me and Mr. Williams talked about a lot, and I found it a lot of fun. Ian Williams is the author of Personals, Not Anyone's Anything, and You Know Who You Are. They are prize-winning books. He is an assistant professor of poetry in the Creative Writing Department at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Visit ianwilliams.ca for more, as well as Ian's Twitter, at IanWillWrite. This new book is published by Random House. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Ian Williams. Professor Williams, good morning.
Hi, good morning. Well, it's good afternoon over here.
Yeah, you're in Toronto today, right?
I'm in Toronto today. Lots of snow.
Yeah, was that home for you?
It was actually just outside of Toronto in Brampton. Mm. But, you know, we always, like, consider home the closest big city. So if you go away, you say you're from Toronto. But Brampton's a place in its own. So I grew up in Brampton and went to university in Toronto. And I lived in Toronto and bought a place before moving to Vancouver.
And so you live in Vancouver now. You teach at UBC.
That's right. Well, couple of years.
Yeah, how have you found it living out here?
Well, it's the only place in Canada you can play tennis, like, in March, right? You just can't do that anywhere else in this country. It's really great. People talk about like the different cultural regions around Canada, and yeah, definitely like west of the mountains, it feels different from the prairies and from Ontario.
And so this book, Reproduction, is coming out now to a lot of anticipation, a lot of goodwill from the literary community across the country. You're someone who's obviously spent a lot of time with it alone. Is it a relief to have it out now?
I've spent a lot of time with it alone, and there was a little bit of nervousness at letting it go, first to my agent, like a couple of years ago. And now it's still odd to see like people carry the book under their arm and talking about it as if it's... it's become theirs, right? That's the real incredible transaction, I think, of writers, that it's mine. It was mine for like 6 years, just mine. No one else read it. And then suddenly it's part of other people's lives and gives them pleasure. And I can kind of see it like looking over its shoulder back at me and saying, hey, over there, you know, it's sort of moved forward and to a large degree, like apart from me.
See, I'm not a writer, and so the proprietary aspect of it would probably confound me in that these characters are obviously yours. What is it like now to talk to readers who have made it their own and who may not see it the way that they appeared in your head over the last 6 years or so?
Right. Well, I've gone into a few conversations where I found myself, like, defending a character to a reader. But I mean, I'm not there to kind of police people's experiences with it. And so it's theirs, and they have a lot of, they're connecting with them on different levels. It's hitting people, via their own experiences and whatnot. And I think that's fantastic. You know, sometimes people think like the author is this authority on the text.
Yeah.
Like you go to the author if you want an answer. And sometimes I have students like emailing me, we're reading your poem in class. Can you tell me if my interpretation is correct? I always resist that, right? It's for them to kind of work through and come to something coherent. So I'm trying to like divorce the authority out of author, right? So
yeah.
I don't have the final pronouncement on what these characters mean or say or do. And you know, in 50 years, they're going to mean and read differently than they do presently, right? We're in a certain kind of context right now.
Yeah, as I was telling you before we started, when I started the book, there were a lot of, I guess most of the characters, not most, well, I'm trying to think now, I didn't like a lot of them. I could relate to them. I guess I was looking for someone that I could relate to, and which is silly for a reader to do, but all readers do that, I suppose.
It's natural.
But the thing that I realized on rereading parts of the book recently was that a lot of these characters are recognizable. And I think that's probably why I didn't like them.
A little too familiar. But it's true. I mean, in our lives, we give people You know, in our lives, we can't always change the people that we surround ourselves with. Like, you're forced to work with certain people, for instance.
Right.
Or you're forced to, like, abide your that cousin of yours who just happens to live in the neighborhood. Or your neighbor, right? They happen to buy a property next to you. You didn't choose those things. Mm. And so we learn how to work with people who we don't always like. And, I mean, a book is really a great kind of little microcosm of that experience. I like to say that it helps us to expand our capacity to empathize, right? Mm. You're stuck with these characters, some of these characters that you don't like, and so you're forced to just kind of roll your eyes or whatever. But it increases your tolerance for unpleasant people.
Yeah, and then on rereading, I was rereading it recently. I was reminded the first time I read it, mm. and thinking. It's hard for me to read fiction, surprising enough, after doing this for 15 years. I still find it a chore. But I remember not wanting to put it down because I wanted to know what happened with these people in particular.
That's great. I love that. You know, like, plot actually matters still. You know, the literary novel is sometimes thought of as this thing that plot is secondary or plot doesn't matter. But we kind of want to know what happens. If someone starts telling you a story about their day, you kind of want to know, well, it depends on who and how long, right?
Yeah,
but
yeah.
You kind of want to know what happens. You don't actually want to know what was the theme of that interaction with so-and-so. Yeah, so plot does give us great pleasure. There are lots of patterns in the book. So, I mean, lots of things kind of recur. So there's also the satisfaction of seeing events come back.
Yeah, and then you can't help but... That aspect of the book, you can't help but think about your own life in those sort of patterns and
right.
that sort of equation,
right.
if you will.
Your own life, I'm sure it's true for you, right? Like, you can see bits of your parents and you in your experience. If you have kids, you can see, like, traces of yourself there. And whether you plan for it or not, it sometimes sneaks up on you at a certain age, right? Like, you look in the mirror and you realize, oh, my mouth is moving like my mother's or whatever. Have you had those?
Yeah, you know, I'm 36, and so... I guess after 30, everything just creeps up on you, and yeah, you're looking in the mirror and I'm like, shit, I look like my dad, you know?
That's right, and you start moving like him or whatever.
Yeah,
it's the strangest thing, right? It's like the storage that your body releases, some kind of capsule that gets unlocked at a certain age, and then like physically, you just start operating and moving like these people.
Yeah.
And you thought you never would, right? Yeah. You could have sworn when you were 15, I'm totally my own person and whatnot. And yeah, so there's lots of that in reproduction, just the inevitability of becoming the people that that raised us and that surround us.
Yeah. This bond of what family is and what we think it is, I mean, that's something that's contended within the book. Do you think you've gleaned some insight into these relationships that we inherit from your own, say?
Mm. No, actually, like, so there's not a lot of my life in there, right? Like, there's Brampton in there, you know, that great kind of suburban feeling in the mid-90s. I tried to capture that kind of energy. I mean, suburban energy is different from city energy. Like, wouldn't you think, like, Burnaby is different from, well, from, like, Vancouver?
Yeah, or like, let's say, Port Coquitlam.
Yeah, okay, a little further out, right?
Yeah.
Very different from, like, the vibe in Vancouver.
Yeah.
And so to capture that suburban energy, like, too often writers are preoccupied with, like, writing from the center, from, like, Toronto or Vancouver or, like, a big city, Montreal.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the element that's true there is, like, the Brampton feeling or vibe in there, or a suburban vibe. But actually, the events of, like, my childhood, and my mother's nothing like Felicia. I'm not like Army. My dad's not like Edgar. Purely fictional. What I would say, though, is like there are little elements of me inside all of those characters, though. So Oliver's love of music, for instance, you know, the desire to be a little bit of a rock star. Felicia's a slightly sort of twisted mind occasionally. Army's optimism and so, you know, take over the world sense, right? So there are little bits of me. In them all, but not really my relationships.
Well, what about some of the wisdom in the book? Because, I mean, I'm sure some readers who've already read it probably told you that they've gleaned something out of the book that's useful or wise. Did you come to that yourself, or And then did you want to, say, impart that on the reader, if you will?
Yeah, I mean, I think the reader should take credit for that if it's helped them. I mean, there was nothing programmatic about my writing of it, right? I didn't start off with, say, with that kind of didactic imperative, like, I'm going to show people that families, blah, 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 like a thesis statement or so.
Yeah.
So there wasn't any of that. What happens is it's just by simply observing a situation with some kind of distance, like the distance of literature, we're able to see our own lives a little bit more clearly. And I think readers are intelligent. I, like, always sort of think that we underestimate readers and we write down to people and we should never do that. Readers are smart and they're constantly correlating what they're reading to their own lives and their experiences and hopes and whatnot. And so, yeah, if there's wisdom there, let the reader take credit for that. I, in fact, think that the book is bigger and smarter and wiser than I am, right?
Mm.
The fact that it took so long to get out and to construct and to put together, there's also something unconscious or subconscious that holds the book together, right? And I would feel when it's not quite right or it's not quite working or whatnot. But to trust the grand design of the project, right, and not to take credit for things that might be accidental or that might have evolved over a long time. Yeah, there are just so many forces involved in writing a book.
What did you learn after having now written and now published this book? I mean, did you get something out of it for yourself?
Yeah, I mean, so it's different from writing poetry, right? The scale of writing a novel is just enormous. It's just such a massive undertaking. And so I would approach it a little bit differently if I were to do it again. Yeah, I mean, I swing back and forth, right? So I'm writing poems right now, and I'm working on another novel.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this next novel is going to be more efficiently written. It's a tighter story, right? It's not so complicated, the story. But I've learned some procedural things about going forward, right? Just how to make better use of your time. But, I mean, it's like the first time that you do anything, the first time that you change a tire, or the first time that you play tennis or whatever. Like, the more you do it, the better you get.
Mm.
So, yeah, I've learned some efficiency.
So some will view your output, your writing, as a progression, say, from going from poetry to short stories to novels. But, I mean, as you just said, you're going back to poetry, and you're doing, I guess, all of it at once. But do you view it, though, as a natural progression? I mean, in the material that your publisher sent, you have these biographies that I'm assuming you wrote about yourself. And
you can tell, eh?
Yeah. There's one line that I found particularly interesting. You said that all four books show the progress of a life. They're books in conversation with each other.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I mean, the genre changes, right? So the form that I use changes, but there's a kind of like progression that's happening. First book, collection of poetry, you know who you are, just about identity and being a Black man, right? So first books tend to be kind of identity books, right? Finding your place in the world. Second book kind of answers that, right? From you know who you are to not anybody's, not anyone's anything, right? The sense that you're not quite as special as either you believe or your parents made you believe or teachers were telling you are. You're actually just quite ordinary. And third book, personal, then now that you are ordinary, how do you reach out and make connections and form connections with people? And so I wrote that in my 30s there. You know that age where you start considering, should I be alone forever or will I be?
Right.
Yeah, how much stake do I have in this? And like after personals, I mean, reproduction, right? So after those failed romances and those failed connections, just kind of biologically ticking away, just fascinated by kids and by how this happens. And, you know, all your friends, you said you're 36, right? Like friends are married off and they're having their first few kids. And you watch all of that happen. And so what drives us, what compels us to just reproduce ourselves like this? Yeah. And so the other books are a little bit more depressing, I think, in title but not in tone.
Right.
So, yeah.
You mentioned this biological clock, and I think we overlook that as guys, that it doesn't
tick
for us, you know, and As you mentioned, I'm 36. A lot of my friends are married. Some of them have kids. Yeah. I mean, I learned early on that that's not what I wanted. But, you know, I was thinking about that. This clock that's ticking, it can tick for some people, and then they say that that's why they have to have kids, and you realize some of them are probably ill suited to have children to begin with.
You go to a hospital room and say that to your buddy, right? You know, you're ill suited to having children.
So that's why I'm telling you, in the hope that they'll listen to this. When it does tick, and when people say this, because for some people, yeah, they're just not suited, but they end up having children themselves. Can we rely on say the messages that we're getting from ourselves about what we ought to do?
You know, I think you're definitely right about there being a sort of biological clock, and that guys have it too. Yeah, mostly it's ascribed as this kind of female experience, but it affects us guys as well. Maybe not so powerfully, and maybe without the social pressure and whatnot.
Mm.
But I think we still kind of feel this, you know, am I going to come home and eat ramen every day? Or, you know, how long is this ketchup going to last? And you just kind of yearn for something else or more. Mm. Does everybody have it? I don't know. I can't say. I find it interesting that you said, like, you know for sure, like, that's not your path, right? Like, that's not for you. How can you be so certain? Like, there was a point in my life where I was absolutely certain about that, too.
I guess, I don't know, I just thought about it, and, I mean, I've got great friends, I've got great family.
Yeah, yeah.
And I've just never felt like I've wanted to add that to it.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, it could change tomorrow if I meet somebody that you know.
Right.
Then I want to have kids, but I just don't see it happening. And you know, you hear this thing about, you know, the 36. It's probably,
it's complicated territory. Like, when we get it to this level of people's desire and their expectations of what the rest of the world wants for us, and, you know, do you want kids because you want to produce a happy person in the universe, or do you want a kid because it fulfills some need in you? Like, is the motivation independent of your own, like, somewhat selfish desire? Is it just kind of a box to check or whatnot? I mean, these things sort of get at the hearts of our, and I mean, it takes up so much time too, right? Like, you don't have a kid and the whole business is done within a couple of years, right? This is a lifelong sort of commitment. The stakes are incredibly high here.
Be selfish on my part that I don't want to do all that, right?
I mean, it could be perceived as selfish on the part of the person who wants to have kids or who doesn't want to have kids. I mean, you could argue either way, don't you think?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, I spent so much time in my head and writing and all of that, and I think it's Edgar who says in the book, no, it's Army, not everybody should reproduce. So, I mean, it's not for all of us, and it's not a deficiency. And, I mean, that's kind of hard to take or to explain, right? There's not something defective or deficient in me. It's just not. It's not my path. It's not for me. But power to you for, you know, populating the planet.
Yeah. Well, one review, I don't know if you read the reviews for the book, but one review said that you created a literary representation of contemporary Canada. What is that like to hear?
That's good to hear. I'm not sure what review that is, but yeah, they're probably, my guess is, speaking about in terms of like diversity, right? Like a diverse cast of characters in the book. But what I hope that would mean is that the book feels Canadian on a deeper level than just kind of demographic. That this is what it feels like to live in this country as opposed to living in Mexico, right? Yeah, so I think there is something in the water, let's say, of that book that feels Canadian. I don't think it's the book. Originally when I was writing the book, I had part of it set in Massachusetts in the States, and then during one of the early revisions, I was like, nope, it's not sitting well there, right? It belongs elsewhere. And then it just became infused and saturated with Canada. That's good to hear. I mean, that's a great compliment. I'm not sure entirely how the reviewer means it, though. I know, you know, it's still kind of early in this process, and I haven't been reading the articles or the reviews. I've just been sort of moving forward.
Right.
But at some point I will.
Yeah.
At some point I'll stop and read them.
So I've read everything I can about you in the book and in preparing for a chat today. And in a couple of interviews, I mean, you've mentioned this already, that it took 6 years to do. And you talk about the challenges of getting this done. What, I mean, you're obviously doing other things. You're teaching, you're writing other stuff. But, I mean, throughout these 6 years, what keeps it going for you?
Yeah, I mean, there's so many things that intervene and say, you know, do something else with your life, right? Like, why are you spending all your time doing this? And, of course, you know, there's the Internet and programs to watch. So it's odd. Like, why does anybody kind of pursue something with so little immediate reward? It's a little bit of compulsion, man. Like, to be honest, I think it's, you know, when guys, like, follow scores on, like, sports scores, and they wake up and they check, you know, the back of the newspaper
right.
on their phone.
Yeah.
And there's this kind of compulsion to see how their team did in that away game last night.
Yeah.
There's that kind of like wiring that starts to happen when the project is going. Like, even if it's not going well, it's like, oh, I've got to solve this thing, got to figure this thing out. And there's no rest until it's done. But I mean, for me, that's a sign that that I'm doing the thing that I'm meant to do in the world. Right? I don't get bored with it, even if the work is difficult and momentarily unsatisfying. I still find it necessary to do,
yeah.
right? It's not just about pleasure, and it's not duty. It's just kind of, I must do this. So, yeah, I mean, that's kind of how I think about it and how I approach it. I don't know if you're the kind of person, like, do you value structure? And, like, every day you wake up and you do the same thing, you have a boiled egg and a bowl of granola kind of thing?
Pretty much, yeah. I mean,
yeah.
Then you see the folly of that, in that you're doing this for 5 days in a row and you're working to the sixth and seventh.
Right.
And then the sixth and seventh day go by too quickly, and then
right.
you're back again. And
right.
and then you realize that how much time has really just been wasted.
That's it, you know. I mean, I tend to be a pretty productive guy, and there's just so much shame that we're taught to feel when we're not being productive.
Mm.
And I mean, the opposite of being productive is not necessarily like squandering time, right? It doesn't mean that I'm just like binge watching Fargo,
yeah.
Which I did. But I mean, there's another sort of space that we can occupy where that's neither productive nor totally a waste of time.
Yeah.
Somewhere in the middle, we can just kind of be. I had a friend a few nights ago tell me that she found herself one day sitting on her couch and stroking her cat for like 10 minutes, not watching TV, not doing anything, just like stroking her cat for 10 minutes. And like, that was a kind of epiphany for her. Like,
yeah.
there are things that she could be. She doesn't need to be on her phone. She doesn't need to be doing anything. But so sometimes we just need to kind of be without the shame of producing all the time.
I mean, I guess that's why I even find this with the shows that I do binge, that they have some, I don't know, redeeming qualities, not the right word, but the,
yeah.
some even if I'm showing off on Twitter that I've watched something, you know, high-minded, at least I can brag about that, right?
There's some benefit to it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's also important that we're driven to do things like binge watching, right? Like,
yeah.
we work so hard that our bodies or our minds, like, demand this alternative and the most extreme version of it to compensate.
Yeah.
Like, we're so out of balance, typically, that we need extreme measures to correct our thinking. Yeah. I don't know. I'm trying more and more to occupy that gray space in the middle, right? That's not like wasting time or being uber productive all the time.
So you're a poetry professor, and and I hated poetry in school, like in when we used to read it and the sort. And only in the few years that I've been doing this podcast, and then I get to talk to poets. I've sort of forced myself to read poetry again, and I've realized now as I've gotten older, just how edifying it is to read. I mean, even poetry that you don't particularly like, when you get through it, if you will, there's something you get something out of it. So, how do you think our discourse? I mean, because we're all anxious about what's happening in the world today.
Right.
How do you think it'd be changed if we read a little bit more poetry, say?
Oh, I think we'd slow down. It's good to actually hear that story from you about your changing relationship to poetry. Because I think after high school, most people just, like, well, I don't know. I can't say most people. But we're taught, like, poetry eventually becomes this really uncool kind of thing.
Yeah.
But no, it actually, it kind of meets a need if you give it a chance, right? If you give it a chance without the obligation, without a teacher saying you must do this.
Yeah.
Find the right poets, find the right voices. And there's something really edifying about it. And it's also just kind of fun, right? Like, poets play so much with language, and they're so precise about, like, articulating a feeling, and they've got just the right analogy for things, that they're kind of like a shorthand for our culture. So, yeah, lots of good happening in the poetry world, and it's enjoying a resurgence right now because of, like, popular poets. But, yeah, that resurgence, I find at UBC, like, there's students who've just been writing poetry all this time, and they sort of share it with a little bit of shame, right?
Mm.
Like, I'm studying biology, but I really, really like writing poems. As if, you know, they ought to be ashamed of that. And there's no shame in that. These things can coexist.
Yeah.
So, yeah, lots of pleasure in poetry, man. It's good that you found your way back to it somehow. And you've talked to a lot of people, right, over...
Yeah.
The last 15 years?
Yeah, I mean, I remember in a conversation I had with Susan Musgrave, and she said, you know, there's poetry and, like, signs in the things, and you just have to look for it, and you'll see it.
Mm.
And,
yeah.
I mean, I you know, you hear it in music, you hear it in certain politicians' speeches. You'll want to read, you know,
mm-hmm.
you want to read Patrick Lane, or you want, you know, right. you'll go find these things that that you want to read, and it just makes it more fun. And yes, you do want to read other things, you know, not just poetry at that point.
It's definitely, like, poetry is a thing, and it's also a quality that you see expressed everywhere, right?
Mm.
Like, some Twitter feeds are just incredibly poetic, or you see a caption on Instagram, and there's something very poetic about it. So it's everywhere, that poetic quality. Yeah, I like to think about poetry in terms of patterns, and so... You spot kinds of patterns, and you see that this thing in my head is like this thing in the world, and you smash them together, and then that forms a kind of a nucleus for a poem. So, yeah, just looking for patterns and looking for, like, pleasure with language and playfulness, and that's the best poems have those kinds of qualities, right? Surprise.
Yeah. So a lot of people might, I'm sure your students do this, with you young people, they want to be writers, and so they ask you for advice. I mean, is your advice sought often?
Yeah, sometimes. I mean, it's most of my students, I'm thinking of my undergrad students, most of them, it's a bit just too early to be thinking about books and publication and all of that. And I just try to acquaint them with the pleasure of the process, the simple pleasure of, like, creating a thing, writing it.
Mm.
And there are many other ways of sharing apart from, like, publishing poems. You can share by going to an open mic. You can share in slam. You can share in many other ways. But I don't know. Sometimes they think that the pinnacle of sharing is only in publication. Yeah, share, get feedback from your friends, make the poem a little bit better. But before thinking about sort of fixing your work in the world, you should really just get acquainted with making poems, right? Just enjoy making poems. That's it. Like, you know, people who make music and maybe their long goal is to have an album at some point, but the short goal is just, you know, they enjoy playing with their friends in a garage.
Yeah.
Yeah, just enjoy making music for a while.
Yeah. And so you have this career as an academic, as a professor. You've just published Reproduction. To good notices. You still write poetry. You have this career that a lot of people probably envy. What is it like for you? I mean, is it as enjoyable as one would suspect it is? I mean, it's awfully busy, though, isn't it?
Well, it's busy right now, but I mean, I also understand that these things are not forever. You know, that one can't always believe the hype, to quote Public Enemy. You know, like at the end of the day, I mean, I've got my bedside routine. There's a kind of separation between the idea of me, like this person that I am with you right now on the phone, the idea of me, and the me of me, right? Like the essence or the essential part of me.
Uh-huh.
And I think sometimes writers, one of those things disappears into the other. But for now, I'm keeping them separate, and they balance each other really well. Just going back daily to writing something, right, and struggling with, oh, this paragraph is not working. So to keep my focus on the work and on the writing rather than on the attention and, you know, the perceived dream, deal with reality.
Yeah. Well, congratulations on this book. It's been such a pleasure talking to you today.
Thanks so much, Joe.
Whether you have a book or whether you're on book tour or not, you're welcome here anytime. Again, I appreciate your time. I've kept you longer than I said it would, but it's been such fun talking to you and reading this book. I hope it does well, and I hope a lot of people pick it up. Thanks for this.
Thanks so much, man.
The book is called Reproduction. It's published by Random House. Ian Williams, its author, joined me on the line from Toronto and Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.